Welcome back to the far middle, the day after Election Day in the United States. Are you happy with the outcome? Are you sad? Are you still not sure? Not sure as to whether you're happy or not, or what the actual outcome is? Well, the most important question of all is, did you vote, for goodness sake? And I hope that you're nodding in the affirmative. I'm going to have a lot to say about the elections and some takeaways, so to speak, soon. One with a far middle spin, of course. I wanted to gather my thoughts on that topic and do it justice where it goes above and beyond what you typically hear out there before I fire it away. So stay tuned. We should have something to talk about here within the next week and the next episode. And since we are coming off of Election Day, which is about as American as you can get, and we are in the middle of a great football season, which is another thing that is about as American as you can get, I thought we would focus our sports dedication for episode 181 to an athlete whose nickname, one of them at least, because he had multiple nicknames, was Captain America. And an athlete that epitomized through his career and his life much of all that is great about being American. Now, some preferred another nickname of his, which was Roger the Dodger. We dedicate this episode to none other than Roger Staubach. Now, Staubach was born in Cincinnati, was an only child. He entered the U.S. Naval Academy in 1961, played quarterback for the midshipmen, and as a sophomore, he got his first opportunity to play in the third game of the season against Minnesota. Boy, that was a tough assignment to start out your collegiate career because he had to relieve the starting QB as the Minnesota defense, which was led by two future NFL Hall of Famers, Bobby Bell and Carl Eller, was basically crushing Navy's offense. Staubach in that game went 0-for-2 passing, was sacked twice. But hey, the good news was that it was all upside for Roger from there. Because a week later, playing against Cornell, he led Navy to 6 touchdowns. A few weeks after that, Staubach started in the famous Army-Navy game. President Kennedy attended that game and saw Roger lead the team to an upset victory. I would say he had a decent next season as a junior in college. I mean, he won the Heisman Trophy that year, the Maxwell Award, and the Walter Camp Memorial Trophy. Not bad. In fact, Roger Staubach is the last player from a military academy to win the Heisman. Navy went 9-1 that year, had a final ranking of number 2 in the nation, and played but lost in the national championship game to Texas. Now, he appeared on the cover of Time in October of that year. And get this, Roger would have also been on the cover of Life magazine for its November 29th, 1963 issue, but for the assassination of President Kennedy, which preempted his appearing on the cover, of course. Staubach is in the College Football Hall of Fame, not a surprise there. In 2007, he was ranked number 9 on ESPN's top 25 players in college football history, college football legend. But his career as a pro, probably even better. But before going pro, there was a little detail that Roger had to fulfill. That was his military duty. And this was when the Vietnam War was just starting to gear up. Staubach could have requested an assignment in the United States, but he chose to volunteer for a 1-year tour of duty in South Vietnam. And when his military service was fulfilled, he became effectively a 27-year-old rookie with the Dallas Cowboys. He won his first Super Bowl in early 1972, was Super Bowl MVP of Super Bowl VI. And how about this? After the season, which was sort of at the height of his career and his powers, he renegotiated his own contract, and he ended up signing a 3-year deal for about $75,000 a year. My, how things have changed. Now, during his final NFL season in 1979, Staubach had career highs in completions, passing yards, and touchdown passes, and he had 27 touchdown passes, just 11 interceptions. That's what you call ending on a high note. He retired much earlier than most expected or anticipated, and he did it to protect his long-term health. He suffered 20 concussions in his playing career, including 6 times when he was knocked out unconscious. Staubach retired from football with the highest career passing rating in NFL history at the time, and in 2010, he was named the number 1 Dallas Cowboy of all time, according to a local poll. And I've got a feeling, I'd bet that he still ranks number 1 if they took the poll again today. Roger was quite successful beyond football. He got into real estate, ended up running a firm that eventually sold for hundreds of millions of dollars. And in 2018, he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Trump. Interestingly, Staubach was one of the first players to receive the award. I say one of because at the same time, you had Minnesota Vikings great defensive tackle Alan Page, who was a prior Far Middle dedication subject. If you recall, he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom at the same time as Roger. Now, I know, how the heck did we make it through 180 episodes and not have a Roger Staubach dedication? Hey, don't accuse me of Pittsburgh Steeler bias against a Dallas Cowboy great. The Steelers went up against Staubach twice in Super Bowls, and the Steelers, I will remind you, won both of those games. So it isn't that. This country gets so much right, case in point being Roger Staubach, and we also tend to take things for granted and grow lax at a moment's notice. That's sort of the tendency of America. I admit I am guilty as the next when it comes to sometimes losing perspective on what matters most with respect to somewhat arcane issues like level of government debt and budget deficits each year. I grew up in the era when people were talking about uncovering ungodly levels of government waste with those infamous $500 toilet seats and $50 screws and things like that. But today, entitlements, they're so huge in driving the deficit and ultimately government debt levels that they indirectly demote the importance of government efficiency and avoiding wasteful spending in our minds. When you're talking, you know, trillions of dollars of current and future commitments in the form of Social Security and Medicaid, Medicare, what's a couple billion of dollars of wasteful spending here or there? But then when you dig in or you think a little deeper, it's clear that making sure wasteful spending is minimized, heck, that's as important today as it's ever been because our debt load and the budget deficit are in such dire condition. So wasteful spend, it still matters, perhaps more than ever. Yet despite the urgency, waste, fraud, and abuse, they are alive and well and quite large when it comes to the federal government. The Government Accountability Office, or GAO, recently estimated that the federal agencies in total that were submitting data it made $236 billion in improper payments last year. That's likely to be a significant underestimation of the total improper payments because not every federal agency provided information to the GAO when it did its study or survey. And of what was reported, out of that $236 billion, 74% was improper payments as overpayments, and only 5% were improper payments as underpayments. And just in case you're doing the math, the rest are other kinds of errors. Now, that $236 billion, obviously it's large, it's not peanuts, but you may not appreciate its full perspective. It's six times more than the Department of Justice's annual budget. Six times. Indeed, eliminating wasteful government spending is something that just about every generation of politicians and policymakers, they trumpet it as a priority. But once again, the recent GAO study proves that more things change, the more they tend to stay the same. There's a connection to be made from what's going on with federal government wasteful spend to our next dot or issue, which is how California is tracking efficacy of a key initiative that the state pours billions of dollars into. The initiative is finding ways to address homelessness. California has built a massive and complicated array of agencies and programs to fight homelessness. And the state and its officials who are tasked with tracking how effective all these resources are to mitigating homelessness, they're clueless and they don't even know where to begin when assessing individual programs in the overall effort. And that's basically what the state auditor has admitted in a new report. What the state auditor did know is that California spent $24 billion over the last 5 years to mitigate the problem of homelessness. But the state auditor wasn't able to go much further. He admitted the state lacks current information on the ongoing costs and outcomes of its homelessness programs because the California Interagency Council on Homelessness has not consistently tracked and evaluated the state's effort to prevent and to end homelessness. That's right from the state auditor himself. Hey, that's a damning statement from the state auditor. We know over those 5 years covered in the audit, California's homeless population grew by roughly 20%, and that 30% of the nation's homeless population today is now found in California. So logic and those metrics would argue that instead of helping people get back on their feet and off the streets, California's multi-billion dollar homelessness industrial complex has had the opposite effect, that of catalyzing an ever-growing population of homeless. And by the way, that homelessness industrial complex I referenced, it consists of 9 state agencies in California and more than 30 individual programs. It is massive, complex, and expensive. But we can't say that it's effective. It may be actually making the problem worse. And this California homelessness topic brings to mind, makes an interesting connection to a question that I receive quite often from constant listeners out there, which is, hey, whatever happened to that far middle feature known as the Fauci focus? Now, that was the feature, some of you may recall, where we would highlight a recent development from the famous expert Dr. Fauci, often a statement or action that ran counter to logic and medical science and common sense. And with most things pandemic policy related now in the rearview mirror, thank God, the Fauci focus lost some of its timeliness. But we recently had an admission by the doc that you should hear about. The doctor recently testified that he didn't have evidence indicating that a 6-foot social distancing rule would be effective in limiting the spread of COVID. Here's what he said. You know, I don't recall. It sort of just appeared. I don't recall like a discussion of whether it should be 5 feet or 6 feet or whatever. Yep, that's what he said. Now, Fauci also said he couldn't recall any studies that showed masking children would help protect them or stop the spread of COVID. And he did acknowledge that forcing the masking of kids was contrary to recommendations from the World Health Organization. And he said that no one bothered to do a cost-benefit analysis of such a requirement. As time passes on and we're able to soberly and objectively assess pandemic policies, we're coming to realize that the ineptitude of our expert class in the medical profession who commandeered policy and individual freedoms to boot during the pandemic has resulted in tangible loss of life that may be too depressing to tally, and in the long term delivered an incredible staining of the credibility and reputation of the expert medical community. Indeed, the legacy of Dr. Fauci is long-term systemic harm to a range of really important stakeholders. Okay, so let's review our prior connection thread. We talked about waste and federal government spending measured in the hundreds of billions of dollars. We then talked about California throwing tens of billions of dollars into tackling homelessness and seeing the metrics go in the opposite direction that it was hoping to see. And then how one of the leaders of the expert class can't seem to remember what it was doing or he was thinking with COVID protocols and policy. How about we make a connection to the next dot, which looks at what's going on with a multinational organization looking to tackle an even bigger issue, this time climate change. Got a story that fits the description that you might find somewhat humorous and somewhat frightening. Now, early last year, 2023, there was an organization that consisted of about 2,000 senior citizen Swiss women who had the objective of branding their country, Switzerland, a human rights abuser. Now, what was their rationale as to why Switzerland was a human rights abuser? The organization claimed that the effects of climate change were so severe that Switzerland was failing to do anything substantive about it, and it constituted a gross mistreatment of the human race. Now, you probably just heard that and enjoyed a chuckle. This is Switzerland we are talking about, a nation not anywhere near the top of my human rights abuser list, or yours, I'm sure, or anyone's, until this organization of senior citizen Swiss women saw it as the nation being a menace to the human race, its home country. Now, here's where it goes from humorous to frightening. The Swiss ladies, their case went to the European Court of Human Rights. Yes, there is such a thing. In the European Court of Human Rights, it assessed what the case was that the Swiss ladies presented, and it agreed with them. The court said that since Switzerland refused to impose caps on CO2 emissions, the nation violated its own citizens' basic standards of decency. Holy heck. The European Court of Human Rights said that given, quote, the serious adverse effects of climate change on lives, health, well-being, and quality of life, end quote, that the petitioners deserved redress. Worse yet, there's no right of appeal. The judgment is legally binding under the rules of the EU and the European Court of Human Rights. So, consider that the European Court of Human Rights has now branded as rogue regimes across the planet the following nations: Russia, Iran, Syria, and now Switzerland. Are you kidding me? It reminds me of that Sesame Street skit of, you know, one of these things is not like the others. One of these things does not belong. No, unfortunately, this is real. This isn't Sesame Street. And it shows the danger of handing over delegating authority from a sovereign nation to an international or multinational organization like the EU and its kangaroo courts. All these connections between the dots and issues that we've been talking about, it speaks to the state or government, whether it's on the federal, local, international levels, and some of the inefficiencies and undesirable consequences that it brings when it looks to impose itself into the private sector and individual decision making. Reminds me of thoughts from a noted, yet a very underrated and underappreciated economist by the name of Vernon L. Smith. Now, people who follow economists, they know him very well, and some of those people will label him a libertarian, some call him a conservative, and some call him a classic liberal. And doesn't that sound familiar to constant listeners who follow the far middle for a while? Because we've discussed that very topic across those three labels in the past. Well, Smith considers himself first and foremost a classic liberal, in case you were wondering. And he recently provided an interview with Jay Nordlinger, and I wanted to share two insights that Smith raised during that discussion. A pair of insights speaking to the importance of the private sector and some of the dangers of government overreach. The first point he made was when he was talking about and discussing if and when America is going to get serious about the national debt and the federal budget deficit, and what happens if it does or doesn't get serious soon. Smith believed that the road to seriousness, if it's too prolonged, it might land or end up with a visit to the land of inflation. And he referenced inflation as the monster, which was channeling the great Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter, who was known to reference inflation as the monster. Schumpeter and many others experienced firsthand the pain of inflation, sustained serious inflation in Europe. And Smith heeded that lesson well, where today he laments that it is a great temptation to a government to pay its bills by simply printing money instead of creating a balanced budget. And the temptation has to be quite large today, with the Federal Reserve tortured logic to cut rates and considering the state of U.S. debt and budget deficits. But look into Europe after World War I and look into places like Africa with Zimbabwe more recently, where it issued a $100 trillion bill in its currency. We should know that such temptation is ultimately going to lead to bad things. Now, the second compelling insight from Vernon L. Smith in that interview, it dealt with the topic of work and the poor. He noted that if you want to help the poor, then one should first focus on raising the value of their work. And what raises the value of one's work? Well, things like education and training. Smith said, I'm going to quote him directly, "If you want to do something about the poor, do something to make them more valuable to other people. We're all of value because of what we provide to other people through markets. The thing about markets is each person has to give in order to receive. And there are huge gains in that. That's why markets have so improved our material well-being for the last 200 or 300 years. That's straight from Vernon L. Smith. Yes, constant listeners, the way to raise the value of people's work is to get government and the bureaucrat out of the way of the private sector. And the way to deal with budget deficits and government debt is to rein in spending and balance budgets, not to print more money. What worries me, and what should worry you, is that the trends we're seeing today in America are in the two opposite directions of what Mr. Smith just prescribed." The wisdom of Vernon L. Smith, a classic liberal or libertarian, however you choose to define him, brings to mind another dot to make a connection to, that being the topic of two critical and strategic nations to the United States and how media is portraying two very different paths in recent elections for each. I don't know what the media are looking at, because I think they got both of these nations wrong or confused. Those nations are Mexico to our south, and our neighbor, of course, and India, a vital partner on the geopolitical stage to the United States. Let's talk about Mexico first. The American media loves what is going on in Mexico. The nation's recent presidential election resulted in Mexico's first female president, Claudia Sheinbaum, which is great, but that covers over a massive substantive problem. Mexico's new president is another outright leftist and a natural policy and philosophical successor to AMLO, as the prior president is referred to, and his policies. And under the new administration, the state will grow its power, the president will become more totalitarian, and the checks and balances of the Mexican system are going to be eroded. Specifically, one should worry about the judiciary's independence if one likes the idea of Western Republican democracy staying in Mexico. And AMLO and the new president, they are eroding property rights. At the end of September, AMLO expropriated an American-owned Yucatan port by deeming the area environmentally sensitive. That was a convenient deeming, and protected, and thus it suspended the company's permit to operate, which is funny because the company received recent awards for its environmental stewardship. But it's actually not funny at all when you consider the sober nature of this. I worry greatly about Mexico, constant listeners, and since they are our neighbors and we share a long border with them, to a large extent, Mexico's problems in their future, its future, will correlate to America's problems and America's future. I see trouble ahead on that front. Now, contrast that with the media's view of what's going on in India. You hear all the time from news stories and outlets about democratic backsliding in India. And Mr. Modi, to some extent, you know, he's beat the drum of religious nationalism as well as waged a degree of lawfare against political opponents. So, now, he's been far from perfect, but recent elections in India, they showed that the anti-Modi coalition significantly overperformed in the actual election relative to the pre-election polling, to the extent where Modi's party was denied an outright majority in the lower house of parliament. Modi is still prime minister, but now he needs a coalition to get things done. And just to put the actual election outcome in comparison to what was hoped for, Modi's party, the BJP, hoped to win 400 seats and ended up winning about 240 seats. Unfortunately, the main opposition in India is a socialist party. Yuck. But the fact of the matter is that roughly 600 million people vote in an election where universal adult suffrage exists and where a ruling party can be handed an election loss. And better yet, the election itself and its results are viewed as credible and fair by Indians. India's political system is far from perfect. But which country can boast of perfection in that arena? Certainly not the United States. But India has much going for it, and it deserves better representation from American and Western media. As I said, our media, I think they got it backwards. Mexico's trending down when it comes to democracy, while India is trending up. How much money can a government spend? How many people have to suffer before policy course is corrected? You know, these are the types of questions that get me thinking of a great final connection to close the episode that we're currently in for this far middle. The final dot will be a short story from 1886, written by a literary giant best known for really long stories, as in War and Peace. Of course, I'm speaking of Leo Tolstoy. And one of his short stories, titled How Much Land Does a Man Need?, was referenced by another giant of literature, James Joyce, as the greatest story that the literature of the world knows. Wow, that's high praise. Tolstoy's short story is about a man who, initially happy in life, he develops a lust for land, and in the pursuit of that lust for land, ends up losing everything that's important to him. It's strange to read this story written by a Russian over 100 years ago and instantly be able to relate to its lessons today. But if you give it a read, and it's an easy read, you'll do just that. Now, the main character in the story is a peasant who overhears his wife and sister-in-law arguing over sort of the merits of town life versus the merits of a peasant farm life. And he thinks to himself, if I had plenty of land, I shouldn't fear the devil himself. But he didn't know this when he was thinking that the devil was listening, and the devil decides to put the peasant to the test of his words. So before you know it, the peasant gets a taste for more land and becomes very possessive of it. And this causes all kinds of arguments with his neighbors. So he moves to a larger area of land at another commune. Yeah, commune, this is Russia after all. And it's a commune where he can grow even more crops and build a small fortune, but you know, he has to grow the crops on rented land. He's not good with that. That irritates him. He wants a little more. So he keeps going, buying and selling a number of different tracts of fertile and good land. He meets a family, ultimately, who he is told are simple-minded, but they own a huge amount of land. And the peasant, he sees more opportunity here. So he proposes to the family that he'll buy as much of their land for as low of a price that he can negotiate. They come back to him with a very unusual offer. They say, okay, for a sum of 1,000 rubles, you can walk around as large of an area as you want. It starts at sunrise, at daybreak, and you mark your route with a spade along the way. And if you return to the starting point by sunset that day, all the land that route that you've laid out that it encloses will be yours. But if you don't reach the starting point by sunset, you're going to lose your money and receive no land. The peasant hears this. He is fired up. He is delighted about this. He thinks he can cover a huge distance and has found the steal of a lifetime. So that night he tries to get to bed and get some rest, but he experiences a surreal dream in which he sees himself lying dead by the feet of the devil, and the devil's laughing at him. Well, he wakes up the next morning. It is go time. He stays out there in the field across the fields as late as possible, marking out land until just before the sun sets. And toward the end, he realizes he's far from the starting point, so he starts to run back as fast as he can to the waiting family who made the wager. He's tired. He's exhausted. He's been out there all day. He finally arrives at the starting point just as the sun sets, and the family cheers his good fortune. But being exhausted from the sun all day and the run, the peasant, he drops dead, and his servant buries him in an ordinary grave only 6 feet long, thus answering the question posed by the title of the story. A man only needs 6 feet of land in the end. How much land do you need, constant listeners? Heed Tolstoy's teachings in thinking about your answer. And as to Far Middle episodes, you may need one a week, and you shall have it. Till the next one, always stay connected to that Far Middle.